Chapter 17. The moving finger, the news of Mrs. Grancy's death came to me with the shock of an immense blunder, one of fate's most irretrievable acts of vandalism. It was as though all sorts of renovating forces had been checked by the clogging of that one wheel. Not that Mrs. Grancy contributed any perceptible momentum to the social machine. Her unique distinction was that of filling to perfection her special place in the world. So many people are like badly composed statues, overlapping their niches at one point and leaving them vacant at another. Mrs. Grancy's niche was her husband's life, and if it be argued that the space was not large enough for its vacancy to leave a very big gap, I can only say that, at the last resort, such dimensions must be determined by finer instruments than any ready-made standard of utility. Ralph Grancy's was in short a kind of disembodied usefulness. One of those constructive influences that, instead of crystallizing into definite forms, remain as it were a medium for the development of clear thinking and fine feeling. He faithfully irrigated his own moldy patch of life, and the fruitful moisture stole far beyond his boundaries. If, to carry on the metaphor, Grancy's life was a sedulously cultivated enclosure, his wife was the flower he had planted in its midst, the embowering tree, rather, which gave him rest and shade at its foot, and the wind of dreams in its upper branches. We had all his small but devoted band of followers known a moment when it seemed likely that Grancy would fail us. We had watched him pitted against one stupid obstacle after another: ill health, poverty, misunderstanding, and, worst of all for a man of his texture, his first wife's soft insidious egotism. We had seen him sinking under the leaden embrace of her affection like a swimmer in a drowning clutch, but just as we despaired he had always come to the surface again, blinded, panting, but striking out fiercely for the shore. When at last her death released him, it became a question as to how much of the madness he had carried with her. Left alone, he revealed numb withered patches, like a tree from which a parasite has been stripped. But gradually he began to put out new leaves, and when he met the lady who was to become his second wife, his one real wife, as his friends reckoned, the whole man burst into flower. The second Mrs. Grancy was past 30 when he married her, and it was clear that as he had harvested that crop of middle joy which is rooted in young despair. But if as he had lost the surface of 18 as he had kept its inner light, if her cheek lacked the gloss of immaturity, her eyes were young with the stored youth of half a lifetime. Grancy had first known her somewhere in the East. I believe she was the sister of one of our consuls out there, and when he brought her home to New York she came among us as a stranger. The idea of Grancy's remarriage had been a shock to us all. After one such calcining, most men would have kept out of the fire, but we agreed that he was predestined to sentimental blunders, and we awaited with resignation the embodiment of his latest mistake. Then Mrs. Grancy came and we understood. She was the most beautiful and the most complete of explanations. We shuffled our defeated omniscience out of sight, and gave it hasty burial under a prodigality of welcome. For the first time in years we had Grancy off our minds. He'll do something great now, the least sanguine of us prophesied, and our sentimentalist demanded: colon, he has done it in marrying her. It was Clayton, the portrait painter, who risked this hyperbole, and who soon afterward, at the happy husband's request, prepared to defend it in the portrait of Mrs. Grancy. We were all, even Clayton, ready to concede that Mrs. Grancy's unwontedness was in some degree a matter of environment. Her graces were complementary, and it needed the mate's call to reveal the flash of color beneath her neutral-tinted wings. But if she needed Grancy to interpret her, how much greater was the service she rendered him? Clayton professionally described her as the right frame for him, but if she defined, she also enlarged. If she threw the whole into perspective, she also cleared new ground, opened fresh vistas, reclaimed whole areas of activity that had run to waste under the harsh husbandry of privation. This interaction of sympathies was not without its visible expression. Clayton was not alone in maintaining that Grancy's presence, or indeed the mere mention of his name, had a perceptible effect on his wife's appearance. It was as though a light were shifted, a curtain drawn back, as though, to borrow another of Clayton's metaphors, Love the indefatigable artist were perpetually seeking a happier host for his model. In this interpretative light, Mrs. Grancy acquired the charm which makes some women's faces like a book, of which the last page is never turned. There was always something new to read in her eyes. What Clayton read there, or at least such scattered hints of the ritual as reached him through the sanctuary doors his portrait in due course declared to us. When the picture was exhibited, it was at once acclaimed as his masterpiece. But the people who knew Mrs. Grancy smiled, and said it was flattered. Clayton, however, had not set out to paint their Mrs. Grancy or ours even, but Ralph's, and Ralph knew his own at a glance. At the first confrontation he saw that Clayton had understood. As for Mrs. Grancy, when the finished picture was shown to her, she turned to the painter and said simply, you've done me facing the east. The picture, then, for all its value, seemed a mere incident in the unfolding of their double destiny, a footnote to the illuminated text of their lives. It was not till afterward that it acquired the significance of last words spoken on a threshold never to be recrossed. Grancy, a year after his marriage, had given up his townhouse and carried his bliss and ours journey away to a little place among the hills. His various duties and interests brought him frequently to New York, but we necessarily saw him less often than when his house had served as the rallying point of kindred enthusiasms. It seemed a pity that such an influence should be withdrawn, but we all felt that his long arrears of happiness should be paid in whatever coin he chose. The distance from which the fortunate couple radiated warmth on us was not too great for friendship to traverse, and our conception of a glorified leisure took the form of Sundays spent in the Grancy's library, with its sedative rural outlook, and the portrait of Mrs. Grancy illuminating its studious walls. The picture was at its best in that setting, and we used to accuse Clayton of visiting Mrs. Grancy in order to see her portrait. He met this by declaring that the portrait was Mrs. Grancy, and there were moments when the statement seemed unanswerable. One of us, indeed I think it must have been the novelist, said that Clayton had been saved from falling in love with Mrs. Grancy only by falling in love with his picture of her, and it was noticeable that he, to whom his finished work was no more than the shed husk of future effort, showed a perennial tenderness for this one achievement. We smiled afterward to think how often, when Mrs. Grancy was in the room, her presence reflecting itself in our talk like a gleam of sky in a hurrying current, Clayton, averted from the real woman, would sit as it were listening to the picture. His attitude, at the time, seemed only a part of the unusualness of those picturesque afternoons, when the most familiar combinations of life underwent a magical change. Some human happiness is a landlocked lake, but the Grancy's was an open sea, stretching a buoyant and illimitable surface to the voyaging interests of life. There was room, and to spare on those waters for all our separate ventures, and always beyond the sunset, a mirage of the fortunate isles toward which our prows bent. 2. It was in Rome that, 3 years later, I heard of her death. The notice said suddenly, I was glad of that. I was glad to basely perhaps, to be away from Grancy at a time when silence must have seemed obtuse and speech derisive. I was still in Rome when, a few months afterward, he suddenly arrived there. He had been appointed Secretary of Legation at Constantinople, and was on the way to his post. He had taken the place, he said frankly, to get away. Our relations with the port held out a prospect of hard work, and that, he explained, was what he needed. He could never be satisfied to sit down among the ruins. I saw that, like most of us in moments of extreme moral tension, he was playing a part, behaving as he thought it became a man to behave in the eye of disaster. The instinctive posture of grief is a shuffling compromise between defiance and prostration, and Bright feels the need of striking a worthier attitude in face of such a foe. Grancy, by nature musing and retrospective, had chosen the role of the man of action, who answers blow for blow and opposes a mailed front to the thrusts of destiny, and the completeness of the equipment testified to his inner weakness. We talked only of what we were not thinking of, and parted, after a few days, with a sense of relief that proved the inadequacy of friendship to perform, in such cases, the office assigned to it by tradition. Soon afterward my own work called me home, but Grancy remained several years in Europe. International diplomacy kept its promise of giving him work to do, and during the year in which he acted as charge d'affaires he acquitted himself, under trying conditions, with conspicuous zeal and discretion. A political redistribution of matter removed him from office just as he had proved his usefulness to the government. And the following summer I heard that he had come home, and was down at his place in the country. On my return to town I wrote him, and his reply came by the next post. He answered as it were in his natural voice, urging me to spend the following Sunday with him, and suggesting that I should bring down any of the old set who could be persuaded to join me. I thought this a good sign, and yet shall I own it? I was vaguely disappointed. Perhaps we are apt to feel that our friend's sorrows should be kept like those historic monuments from which the encroaching ivy is periodically removed. That very evening at the club I ran across Clayton. I told him of Grancy's invitation and proposed that we should go down together, but he pleaded an engagement. I was sorry, for I had always felt that he and I stood nearer Ralph than the others, and if the old Sundays were to be renewed I should have preferred that we two should spend the first alone with him. I said as much to Clayton, and offered to fit my time to his, but he met this by a general refusal. I don't want to go to Grancy's, he said bluntly. I waited a moment, but he appended no qualifying clause. You've seen him since he came back? I finally ventured. Clayton nodded. And is he so awfully bad? Bad? No. He's all right. All right? How can he be, unless he's changed beyond all recognition? Oh, you'll recognize him, said Clayton, with a puzzling deflection of emphasis. His ambiguity was beginning to exasperate me, and I felt myself shut out from some knowledge to which I had as good a right as he. You've been down there already, I suppose? Yes, I've been down there. And you've done with each other, the partnership is dissolved? Done with each other? I wish to God we had. He rose nervously, and tossed aside the review from which my approach had diverted him. Well, look here, he said, standing before me, Ralph's the best fellow going, and there's nothing under heaven I wouldn't do for him short of going down there again. And with that he walked out of the room. Clayton was incalculable enough for me to read a dozen different meanings into his words, but none of my interpretations satisfied me. I determined, at any rate, to seek no farther for a companion. And the next Sunday I traveled down to Grancy's alone. He met me at the station and I saw at once that he had changed since our last meeting. Then he had been in fighting array, but now if he and grief still housed together it was no longer as enemies. Physically the transformation was as marked but less reassuring. If the spirit triumphed, the body showed its scars. At 45 he was gray and stooping, with the tired gait of an old man. His serenity, however, was not the resignation of age. I saw that he did not mean to drop out of the game. Almost immediately he began to speak of our old interests, not with an effort, as at our former meeting, but simply and naturally, in the tone of a man whose life has flowed back into its normal channels. I remembered, with a touch of self-reproach, how I had distrusted his reconstructive powers. But my admiration for his reserved force was now tinged by the sense that, after all, such happiness as his ought to have been paid with his last coin. The feeling grew as we neared the house, and I found how inextricably his wife was interwoven with my remembrance of the place. how the whole scene was but an extension of that vivid presence. Within doors nothing was changed, and my hand would have dropped without surprise into her welcoming clasp. It was luncheon time, and Grancy led me at once to the dining room, where the walls, the furniture, the very plate and porcelain, seemed a mirror in which a moment since her face had been reflected. I wondered whether Grancy, under the recovered tranquility of his smile, concealed the same sense of her nearness, saw perpetually between himself and the actual her bright unappeasable ghost. He spoke of her once or twice, in an easy incidental way, and her name seemed to hang in the air, after he had uttered it, like a chord that continues to vibrate. If he felt her presence, it was evidently as an enveloping medium, the moral atmosphere in which he breathed. I had never before known how completely the dead may survive. After luncheon we went for a long walk through the autumnal fields and woods, and dusk was falling when we re-entered the house. Grancy led the way to the library, where, at this hour, his wife had always welcomed us back to a bright fire and a cup of tea. The room faced the west, and held a clear light of its own after the rest of the house had grown dark. I remembered how young as he had looked in this pale gold light, which irradiated her eyes and hair, or silhouetted her girlish outline as she passed before the windows. Of all the rooms, the library was most peculiarly hers, and here I felt that her nearness might take visible shape. Then, all in a moment, as Grancy opened the door, the feeling vanished and a kind of resistance met me on the threshold. I looked about me. Was the room changed? Had some desecrating hand effaced the traces of her presence? No, here too the setting was undisturbed. My feet sank into the same deep-piled Dagestan. The bookshelves took the firelight on the same rows of rich subdued bindings. Her armchair stood in its old place near the tea table, and from the opposite wall her face confronted me. Her face, but was it hers? I moved nearer, and stood looking up at the portrait. Grancy's glance had followed mine, and I heard him move to my side. You see a change in it? He said. What does it mean? I asked. It means that 5 years have passed. Over her, why not? Look at me. He pointed to his gray hair and furrowed temples. What do you think kept her so young? It was happiness. But now he looked up at her with infinite tenderness. I like her better so, he said. It's what she would have wished. Have wished? That we should grow old together. Do you think she would have wanted to be left behind? I stood speechless, my gaze traveling from his worn, grief-beaten features to the painted face above. It was not furrowed like his, but a veil of years seemed to have descended on it. The bright hair had lost its elasticity, the cheek its clearness, the brow its light. The whole woman had waned. Grancy laid his hand on my arm. Why, you don't like it? He said sadly. Like it? I've lost her. I burst out. And I found her, he answered. In that, I cried with a reproachful gesture. Yes, in that. He swung round on me almost defiantly. The other had become a sham, a lie. This is the way she would have looked, does look, I mean. Clayton ought to know, oughtn't he? I turned suddenly. Did Clayton do this for you? Grancy nodded. Since your return? Yes. I sent for him after I'd been back a week. He turned away, and gave a thrust to the smoldering fire. I followed, glad to leave the picture behind me. Grancy threw himself into a chair near the hearth, so that the light fell on his sensitive, variable face. He leaned his head back, shading. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.